Well, let's talk a little bit about you and how it all began, and about your new book. I understand that in the early 1950s, it's kind of delicate subject. I'm almost embarrassed to bring this subject up, knowing that you were once prosecuted as a pornographer. It's very embarrassing for the audience to know that here's a man charged with obscenity. But
prosecuted but exonerated. But it wasn't I that wrote the pornography. It was Allen Ginsberg. We were at City Lights Bookstore. We were accused of publishing and selling this supposedly obscene work. But we were exonerated by a judge who handed down the precedent that stood ever since and allowed a lot of big publishers to publish. People like Henry Miller, the principle being that you can't judge or even consider something obscene if it has the slightest redeeming social significance. That's the key phrase that stood up all these years.
Now, it's hard for us today to understand what the climate was back before the 1960s,
well,
or even
the
early
60s. Too hard to understand, because under the Reagan administration, you have an attrition of civil liberties also. You know, and it could be worse under Bush and Quayle. Mr. Quayle could be very well, he'd make a very good president of the National Golfing Association if he had a smart caddy.
Otherwise. That's right. No, I think you'd...
I mean, to evoke this, the 50s was the McCarthy era. That is Senator Joe McCarthy. And a time of political and artistic repression on a lot of levels. Besides the Un-American Activities Committee, there was a lot of active censorship going on besides the censorship of, or the attempted censorship of books such as Ginsberg's Hell.
Yeah, I did a profile of Ginsberg a little while ago, last year, I guess, and he was telling me that whenever he came back from a foreign country, he would be strip searched at the airports.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were singling him out. And we don't even know why. I mean, as he said... Mm-hmm. I was just a poet, and they're strip-searching me. I mean, he wasn't even carrying a gun or anything. He was just a poet.
Well, he was on their list, and he was notorious already by the end of the Hell trial, 1956.
You had the bookstore, City Lights, at that time, didn't you?
We started in 1953. We just celebrated our 35th anniversary this year, standing on the same corner for 35 years.
Congratulations, and happy birthday. But how did a bookseller and a book publisher such as yourself know what to do? If you publish a poem like Howl and are prosecuted, aren't you afraid to publish anything?
I know. That's just what the government or forces of censorship always count on. They realize that a small enterprise, a small business, can't really withstand this kind of charge because they don't have the money for legal defense. Luckily, we had what Bush considers infamous. The American Civil Liberties Union defended us, and if it hadn't been for the American Civil Liberties Union, we wouldn't exist today. I mean, they defended us in the Howell trial, and it's a continuing battle on censorship, as you know. I mean, it keeps coming up, And
yet, in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, there seemed to be a great deal of acceptance of censorship, wasn't there? I mean, it was popular enough that people, the government, could get away with it.
Well, maybe it wasn't so popular. It wasn't popular among intellectuals, but nevertheless, they didn't say very much. They didn't raise their voices, so they were like they were being good Germans.
Well, one of your publisher, Barney Rossett... here in
actually, my publisher was New Directions, James Laughlin.
I'm sorry.
But I was published in an anthology by Barney Rossett.
You're absolutely right. Somehow I link.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, I link Laughlin and Barney Rossett together. Their books are a lot alike, and they both have taken chances. I've interviewed Laughlin, and I don't believe he had any. I don't believe he ever had any legal difficulties. But Rossett, of course, did, and he had the ladies Chatterley's Lover, and it was very courageous of him to publish that book and to single-handedly, practically, fight the government and win.
And he had the Howell precedent to support him also. the books, when Rossett published Lawrence, and when he published Henry Miller, the Howell precedent was on the books, and it was important. I remember when he came out to see Henry Miller, he trying to get Miller to agree to the publication of The Tropics for many years, and I think it was about his third or fourth trip to Big Sur to see Miller, and I saw him on a street corner in San Francisco. He says, well, I'm going to make one more trip down there, try and persuade Henry, and that time he was successful, and they published The Tropics. James Laughlin said he always said, even though Laughlin, that New Directions, was the main and original publisher of Henry Miller in the United States, he always said he didn't have the financial resources to defend Miller's Tropics, because he knew they'd be busted.
Mm. The title of one of your books of poetry is Starting from San Francisco, mm-hmm. a book that I bought back, I think, about 1962, something like that, and that's another one I've carried around with me. But did you actually start in San Francisco? Where did you begin?
Oh, I'm from New York.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Yonkers boy.
Uh-huh.
But I immediately after I was born, a French aunt of mine spirited me away to France, where I spent about the first 6 years of it. Spoke French before English. And but generally, I was a New Yorker.
Well, I was going to ask about that.
Went to Columbia University, graduate school.
I was going to ask about
it. Lived in the village when it was still the village.
And what did you study at Columbia?
I was in the English department.
An English major. What did you plan to do with your English degree?
Right. I wasn't interested in teaching. Just to get time to write. So then I went to France on the GI Bill and managed another 5 years over there.
You were in the service, huh?
Yeah, I was in the Navy 5.5 years, 4.5 years. I was a skipper of a sub chaser in the Normandy invasion.
And,
wow. It was 5 years of sea duty.
Wow. Yeah, I noticed your ability to speak French is very apparent in your new novel, and of course, in this, I think this was your last book of poetry, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it? And many of the poems in Over All the Obscene Boundaries are in French. I was going to ask you about that
mm-hmm.
French influence, but you're practically, well, you're a Francophile then, practically, aren't you?
I guess that's what they call them. Anyway, this book, the new book is called Love in the Days of Rage, and it's the Paris 68 student revolution as a background for a love story between an American woman expatriate painter and a French banker.
Could we work up to this? I want to get a little
yeah,
more background
yeah.
and
oh, sure.
Kind of just bring us up chronologically. It'll be easier when I cut the
mm-hmm.
the tape. You went to Columbia on the GI Bill. What happened after Columbia? What happened?
I went directly to France on the GI Bill.
Oh, to France.
I was at the Sorbonne and got a doctorate finally. 4 years of sitting in cafes, and I managed to escape with this degree.
What happened next? It's a cliffhanger. What happened?
Well, I went from Paris after Christmas 1950. I was in San Francisco by New Year's, and never been west before. One of my French buddies said, well, you drink a lot of wine. San Francisco is the only real wine-growing region in the United States. Why don't you go there? So I did. I used to make up literary reasons why I went out there, but the real reason was I liked the wine. It was cheap. And then we started City Lights Bookstore in 1953. My original partner, who had the brilliant idea of starting the first paperback bookstore in the United States, was Peter Martin, who was the son of Carlo Tresca, a famous Italian anarchist who was assassinated on the streets of New York a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Martin later had the New Yorker bookstore in New York here.
Oh, it's a great bookstore on Broadway, I believe.
Went out of existence about 10 years ago now,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I used to haunt that store.
He was a brilliant fellow.
Yeah. What happened to
Carlo Tresca's son?
You know, have you kept up with
him? He died about a year ago now.
Well, you started City Lights Bookstore, unusual, paperbacks only. I guess you were
mm-hmm.
appealing to people who really didn't have the wherewithal to go after hardcovers.
In 1953, paperback books weren't considered real books. Bibliophiles and bookstores didn't consider paperbacks as real books, except for Penguins, which was one of the few lines of paperback books that existed then.
Was City Lights a hit?
Oh, yeah, the idea was to support a little magazine called City Lights that Pete had and pay the rent for the little magazine by opening this little one-room pocket bookstore. And we couldn't get the door closed from the minute we opened. It was open from 10 a.m. to midnight right from the beginning. And it still is, 7 days a week. And that's what happened when the paperback revolution, so-called, came along.
How did the publishing arm get started?
More or less to support the bookstore, and I often wondered why more bookstores don't publish books. I know some do it very rarely, but as a regular program, there's hardly any. I don't know of any in this country that do it now. It's a very logical thing. It's really a symbiotic relationship. Some years our bookstore supported the publishing, other years the publishing supported the bookstore, and still does.
Your name has always been linked with the beat writers of the 1950s. Maybe that's primarily because of Howell and Ginsberg. Of course, you and Ginsberg are much different in terms of writers.
I got associated with the beat writers by publishing them.
Mm-hmm.
When they were around New York and Times Square or Columbia University, I was living in a French family in Paris working on a French doctorate. I didn't get to know any of them until I came to San Francisco. A bookstore naturally is a magnet for poets, and I started meeting all the poets that came by, and they came by, and no one was publishing them. There was a whole generation of writers that New York publishers didn't seem to be interested in. That's how most publishing houses get started.
I wonder a little bit about these early poets, these early beat poets that you published.
Stone Age hippies?
Stone Age hippies, yeah. Some of them have vanished. Ginsberg has held on. Burroughs,
he certainly hasn't vanished. Allen Ginsberg is like central to the New York literary establishment.
Yeah, he really is. Really is, and he's everywhere. I mean,
he's very active in Penn, for instance.
I covered the Penn International Convention 2 years ago when it was held here in New York, and I think Ginsberg was there 24 hours a day, because every time I turned around, he was giving interviews.
Where was this?
Here, the Penn International Conference.
Oh, yeah.
And that was held 2 years ago in a collection of hotels off of Central Park South. It was a wonderful experience. CBS gave me the week off. I didn't have to do any newsroom duties just to cover it. And almost everybody who was anybody around the world came to that. And Ginsberg was certainly one of the most visible characters. He was passing out petition. I can't remember everything. He still is involved politically, obviously. And he was passing out petitions to anybody who would take
it. Was it 3 years ago now, was it?
Maybe it was 3 years ago, something like that. It was a great experience.
Well, I think that was the time he came back from a visit to Nicaragua, and there was a petition he circulated supporting the Sandinistas, which is...
Yeah, I think it was Latin American, but I just can't remember now. There was so much going on, and that was one of the lesser moments, but he was certainly visible.
Well, I should say, I should be more precise. Alan always liked to be very precise. He wasn't supporting Sandinistas. He was supporting a small government, he was supporting the right of a small government not to be harassed and persecuted by a large power. He was supporting the right... non-interference.
Well, I could check that if it ever... Yeah, it's not important, but I mean, I kept all of that material. I have a box full of the Penn Congress material there, including his petitions and everything. And Burroughs, of course. I always had this feeling Burroughs never wrote his own stuff, but I mean, have you ever... You know Burroughs, don't you?
Of course.
I don't know why I have that feeling. I've talked to him, but he never seems... a number of times, and he never seems to be... in the same room with me.
Well, you see, he's el hombre invisible, as that's one of his own terms, the invisible man, in his early books. And his early method of composition was a cut-up technique, which quite often wasn't his own words originally. He would cut up texts, actually physically with scissors, cut up a page vertically, and then unmatch and rematch the lines to suit his own fantasy, so that you came up with a new collage text, which wasn't original with anyone. I mean, it was someone else's words cut up but made original in his new version. So, but then his later books weren't written that way.
No, I think he has a trilogy of Western books.
Oh, yeah.
I've read one or two of them. They seem more conventional.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it's a put-on, too. And the whole idea of that you have the feeling that he didn't write is partly a put-on. It's like a con man. The whole thing is a con man routine.
Well, it said those people who love Burroughs will love Burroughs, and those people who haven't read him before may have some distance between him. I have mixed feelings about him, but he's certainly an interesting character. Have you been down to his bunker? He's on the Bowery. He's got a place he calls the Bunker, and it used to be, I believe, either a health spa or a YMCA or something. And his bathroom still has urinals, and it really is like a bunker. It's like a loft, and you go through these heavy doors and everything. And so I've been down there a couple of times to interview him, and a huge open space, like a factory. Maybe it was a factory. It's just very strange. Kerouac, what was he like?
Well, Kerouac was essentially a French Canadian, a French Canuck from Lowell, Mass. He spoke Quebecois with, or Joual with his mother. And he looked like a lumberjack when he was young, a French Canadian lumberjack. A park was just dedicated to him in Lowell, Mass. I was there at the dedication this June. The town which reviled him most of his life for what he had written, just as Asheville, North Carolina, reviled Thomas Wolfe. This town that had reviled him did reverse itself last year over the protests of one councilman who didn't want a drunk to be idolized by the city. And the Council of Lowell passed a resolution to have a big public park in the center of Lowell, and there it is. The beautiful marble pillars with quotations from Kerouac's book on it, on them.
Incredible how time sanitizes people, isn't it? I mean, in his lifetime, Jack would have never thought I could have a park named after him.
I know.
Why is it I have this feeling that there was something awfully self-destructive among these beat writers?
Well, you can say that about anyone who drinks too much or takes too many drugs. But I would say the ones that died, like Kerouac, certainly self-destructed. I mean, Jack drank too much. Too bad he drank too much. He'd be around today to enjoy his fame. But most of them have survived, and they didn't self-destruct. I mean, you could say just the opposite, that people like Ginsberg and Burroughs were lessons in how to survive. I mean, they didn't go down the drain.
I don't know. Ginsberg certainly hasn't. Burroughs is kind of like a walking zombie at times, where he's just not present, and you just wonder how he can sit at a typewriter.
I know he has a feeling of not being there when you're in the room with him, and it's the presence. It comes from being an ex-junkie, I think.
But he answers all the questions.
It's sort of like he's also from St. Louis, and he has an accent, a St. Louis accent with a placage of London, British accent over it, just like T.S. Eliot, who was also from St. Louis and lived in London. And I turned on a recording of Eliot or Burroughs, and I thought it was T.S. Eliot. I mean, I thought I'd mixed up my tapes. Same voice, practically.
Burroughs went to Harvard.
And you could just about see the rolled umbrella under the table.
Yeah. I think Burroughs has a little Harvard in him, too, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. I believe so, yeah.
Ken Casey wasn't part of the Beats, was he? He was a little bit later, wasn't he?
Well, he was sort of the Paul Bunyan of the Beat generation.
Explain that.
Well, Casey's writing is sort of Bunyan-esque, and it's wild and western and lumberjackish.
Yeah, well, that one book.
Sometimes
I Have a Great Notion was about a lumberjack family, I believe.
I went to a Jack Kerouac conference in Boulder, Colorado, with the Naropa Institute about 7 years ago, and Kesey and his gang blew in on a big flatbed truck or some other enormous monster of a truck in the middle of the conference, and you had a feeling they were going to come into this coffee house and whip out some chainsaws and saw off the legs of all the tables during the poetry readings.
I have a feeling, though, they've settled down. I did an interview with Robert Stone, who was part of Kesey's group, and he swears he's off of booze, he's off of drugs, he doesn't do LSD anymore, and he's going to concentrate on his writing, turn out more books. They're going 20 years between books is not too good for a writer.
Well, I don't know him all that well. I mean, same with...
I think, what were they called, the Merry Pranksters?
Yeah, the Merry Pranksters.
Yeah, so he was part of...
He had that big bus with the in the place where the destination sign is, it said further.
Yeah, Stone traveled with Kesey. So. Let's move on, because we're just about out of time, but let's go on to your work and your new novel, which is set in Paris, 1967 and 1968. Tell me what led up to your creation of this book.
Well, I was in Paris in the spring of 68, and then I went back 3 summers ago, and I had a studio at the American, courtesy of the American Center, and I started running into people that I'd known in 68, and some of my French buddies, and one of whom was in Daniel Cohn-Bondy's original group of Enragé, which was the original group that got the French student revolution started in 68, and so I started thinking about it, and then I went to the Beaubourg Museum, read all the microfilm from all the newspapers and magazines from that period, and sat in cafes and wrote the book.
Let's talk about your characters a little bit. Annie is from your hometown of Yonkers.
Yeah, she's an American painter who's been an expatriate for 15 or so years, and she's about 40 at the time of this book, and she meets a banker who's very rich and successful and who claims to be an anarchist and claims to be against the system. And the book is a love story, but with the political basis of her trying to get him to put his actions where his mouth is and do something to promote the student revolution.
And of course it appears, Julian appears, that he's not doing anything, and he becomes very suspicious, but without giving the story completely away, Julian does state that he's going to place a plastic bomb in a train. Now, you created a cliffhanger, because the final pages, we have Annie going up in the mountains and on the horse. And they're lovely images there, and she's supposed to meet Julian in this hideaway. But I wasn't sure if the bomb actually went off. Did Julian actually appear? What happened? Is there going to be a sequel?
Well, no, I don't think so. But there are some great novels that leave you hanging on the cliff like that. And I thought it was an appropriate place to stop, because I didn't know what was going to happen to them. Already I've received a letter in which a woman fabricated an ending for me, which she said that Julian was arrested when the train exploded and spent many years in jail and was killed in a shootout when he was among prisoners trying to escape from this French jail. And many years later, Annie, the American painter, was a housewife in Connecticut with children.
No, that's not good. She goes back to Yonkers and opens a bookshop.
That's better.
why doesn't that person write the sequel? No. Write the follow-up? You know, it could well happen that she'll get the urge to do a follow-up to
that. But that would be more of a fabrication, whereas this was really based on a lot of genuine gut feeling for 68. And the book is really an attempt to revivify the best part of the spirit of 68, in a time, that is today, when spirit is really needed again.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that for a second. The you were telling in the book about the revolution and how it was a worldwide revolution in 68.
It was a youth quake.
A youth quake, yes. But it was never very clear to me exactly what the youth were quaking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
where were you?
Well, I was a broadcast journalist, but even then I wasn't clear. There were questions about the rebellion. There were at that time, and there still are, because the 60s were marked with rebellion, often for the sake of rebellion. In fact, Doris Lessing, in her book The Good Terrorist, writes very specifically that sometimes the revolutionaries that she wrote of were captivated by the sound of their own slogans.
Mm-hmm.
And you can certainly rebel against specific injustices, but somehow I had the feeling that there was a revolution among these students in your book and elsewhere for the sake of revolution, as if it was something to do, as if it was something stylish.
Well, of course, there were many people that did do revolution, still do revolution for personal reasons like that. But when I say this is the best of 68 is something we need today, is I mean that this is a technocratic age with technocrats running for president, and the computer mentality seeming to dominate more and more, and so that 68 is an antidote to all that, in that it was, among other things, a protest against the dehumanization of men and women, and the whole pressure of this technocratic age that's taken over today. Feeling and humanity seem to be out the window. It's.
I don't know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I understand that City Lights Bookstore is using computers now.
We have a computer backstage only for typesetting. We're doing PageMaker typesetting for the books we publish.
Do you know what William Burroughs could do with a Macintosh? He could throw away his scissors.
I'm sure he has one.
He could throw away his scissors.
Probably got two.
Well, this Love and the Days of Rage is a poetic book, and it stands alone as a poem, in fact. If you had spread out the sentences a little more, it could have been a poem. It's a very pretty book and a moving book, and it was certainly a treat talking to you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.